This is the penultimate episode of the season. There's only one more chapter after this before the show goes on hiatus. You can follow me on social media for updates on when season 4 will begin, but I have to admit, it's going to be a ways off. In the meantime, consider becoming a patron. Go to sonofelpodcast.com/support. It's just a couple bucks each month, but it both boosts my confidence and offers a little bit of support that I could really use. So thank you. Now enjoy the show. You're listening to Book 2 of Superman, Son of El. He is more than a story. He is more than a comic book superhero. He is more than a symbol of hope. He represents our greatest aspirations. He is everything we think we can be. And yet, even with all the strength and all the power in all of the world, he may not be able to meet his greatest challenges and redeem his family's legacy, for he is the Son of El. Chapter 18, Under the Surface. In light of the dawning realization that Victor Sage's conspiracy theory all centered around Tio Maro, Clark intended to go to bed and deal with it in the morning. Yet to his surprise, he found Lana still awake. As he got into bed, she rolled onto her side to face him.
I was just thinking about how amazing you did this week. I am so proud of you. If I could tell the world that I was Superman's wife, I would be bragging about it every chance I got.
That's real sweet of you, but you might not want to brag if people knew it took me 2 years to realize Victor Sage was making a pun every time he referred to tomorrow.
Hold up a second. A pun?
He was talking about T.O. Maro from the Justice League International. Tomorrow. Get it? Apparently, the first name on the first note Sage gave me was a student of Maro's. I have a feeling if I start looking, they'll all link back to him.
Oh, this mystery just got even better. Are you going to call him? Are you going to call the man with no face?
I just did. He doesn't trust me after seeing Clark Kent next to Superman. Now he thinks we're related.
He's pretty astute. You gotta give him that.
Once they started talking about Sage's mystery, neither of them could fall asleep. Instead, they started looking deeper into the names Victor Sage had provided. There were six of them, all scientists, working in pairs. Clark had done a modest amount of investigating when he first learned of them, though he had not followed up. It turned out that in the time since Clark had looked into them, these scientists had all done very well in their fields of study, pioneering groundbreaking research. Lana noticed a trend.
Each of them made big breakthroughs just after Victor Sage gave you their names. Whatever he knew, he was predicting some huge technological leaps.
Clark hadn't caught this pattern before, but Lana was right. Still, the question remained. What was Tio Maro's connection to these other scientists? And did he have any part in their recent breakthroughs? The next day, after picking up the kids at school and getting them all to their extracurricular activities, Clark flew to Gotham to share this new information. Bruce Wayne was more amused than anything else.
So, Sage found something. Surprising. Though it still might be a coincidence. His track record isn't great.
Can you cross-check some dates for me? I want to see if we can correlate them and Maro being at the same time and place. Maybe sometime shortly before Sage provided me their names.
Not a problem.
As Bruce worked, Clark struck up small talk.
Where's Damian?
Out on patrol. Dick is wearing the cowl tonight while I'm recovering from an injury. It's probably for the best. The two of them have a different dynamic with one another than either of them have with me. It's good for Damian. It gives him perspective.
The chit-chat was brief as the results for Clark's query became apparent. Bruce pieced it together.
Well, that was nearly too easy. Each of them attended conferences in their field of study just weeks before Sage contacted you. Thomas Maro was the keynote speaker at each of these conferences.
Now that sounds like a start. Thanks.
Bruce cocked his head back.
That's it? What do you plan to do with this information?
I figure this is a matter for Clark Kent to look into.
Bruce shook his head. Good luck with that.
He sounded sarcastic, but going into this, Clark had doubts of his own and was happy to receive any luck offered to him, even if it was the sarcastic sort. William Magnus and Niles Calder were the first on Clark's list. Magnus had studied under T.O. Morrow, and Calder now studied under Magnus. Together, under Dr. Magnus's guidance, they had created a new form of shape-shifting android. When Clark arrived for a scheduled meeting with the two men, a golden metallic robot answered the door for him.
"Greetings. You must be the reporter we are expecting. Mr. Clark Kent. My name is Auriferous. It is a pleasure to meet you. I will lead you to my father."
The metal man glided as he strode. The lack of any bounce in his step was uncanny. Steady, yet fluid. He led Clark to the main lab where the two men awaited. The moment Clark entered, the men stood and strode toward him. One was tall and lanky, standing nearly a foot over the other. The shorter of the two men outstretched his arm to shake Clark's hand.
"Clark Kent, pleasure to meet you."
The man had slicked back hair and wore a tie and suspenders. Clark recognized him from photos.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Dr. Magnus."
"Oh, please. Even my students don't call me that. Either call me Will or Doc. Pick one and go with your gut. This here is Niles."
"I would have preferred Mr. Calder, but you may call me by my given name, as Will suggests. Well, either way, it's a pleasure to meet you both."
Magnus beamed a charming smile back at Clark.
"The pleasure's ours, Clark. I hope you don't mind me calling you Clark. I've read all your books. Great stuff. I don't know what this next one is about, but I would love to be included in whatever that might be."
"You aren't worried I might find something you don't want published?"
"Whoa, now I'm really curious what this book is about. But no, Clark, Magnus Labs is entirely on the up and up. I'm not worried in the slightest."
Clark scratched his head.
"Honestly, I'm not too sure what it's about either. I'm just starting out on this next one, getting myself up to date with recent advancements in technology. Things are going pretty fast these days. And honestly, Auriferous here is rather impressive."
The android gave a curt bow.
"Thank you, sir."
"Oh, you're welcome."
Will Magnus responded to Clark's compliment himself.
"If you're impressed now, let me show you around."
Auriferous interrupted before they began.
"Shall I prepare a charcuterie arrangement, Father?"
"Do that, Auriferous. Though before you do, finish prepping the containment bed."
"Of course, Father."
Will and Niles gave Clark a very thorough tour. Along the way, Will described to Clark their next experiments, a series of variations on Auriferous, creating different formulas of his alloy matrix. When the tour ended and they found their charcuterie tray awaiting, Clark asked about Morrow.
"I understand you were a prized student of T.O. Morrow. Has he contributed to this project along the way?"
"Only in that I've learned the fundamentals of my understanding from him. I don't know if you're familiar with Arthur Ivo. Genius of a man. Morrow studied under Ivo, aiding him in his most advanced creations. No one's quite sure what happened to it, but Ivo created an amazing android. He called it the Androidal Meta-Adaptive Zenith Organism. A lot of details were lost with Ivo, but it was the inspiration for Auriferous here."
"Has Morrow contributed recently to the project?"
"Oh no, not at all."
Niles Calder muttered.
"And he can leave us alone about it and stop trying to take our credit."
"What was that?"
Will Magnus waved a hand at the matter.
"Nothing at all. Thomas is a complicated man. He'll get over it."
This allusion was the most these men would elaborate on Morrow's involvement. Clark did not dwell on the matter any longer. It was better he not call attention to the true purpose of his visit just yet. His next meeting was the following day with Linda Holland and Karen Faulkner at Star Labs facility in Coast City. The two women had stirred up worldwide controversy the previous year by successfully merging plant and animal DNA. Linda Holland enthusiastically welcomed Clark to their lab.
"Wow, you're the guy that interviewed Superman. It's so crazy how much you two look alike."
Karen Faulkner shook her head.
"I don't see it. I mean, there's definitely a resemblance, but honestly, it's a stretch. I'm Dr. Faulkner. You can call me Kitty. This is my associate, Dr. Linda Holland. And what can we do for you, Mr. Kent?"
"You can call me Clark, and I'm just researching the biggest scientific breakthroughs of the past year, so naturally I had to come here to meet you two."
Kitty pursed her lips and rolled her eyes.
"Well, Clark, you've got some real pull because the people upstairs told us we had to set aside our day for this. Better yet, we don't have much to show you."
Contrary to Dr. Faulkner's claim, Clark marveled at the array of plant life in their lab, though he was there to see the controversial green mice he had read about. Of them, only one remained. It was a chartreuse shade of green, and was indeed able to make energy from light. But the two scientists explained that their test subjects were unable to regulate their blood sugar and eventually all died due to a unique kind of diabetes. Dr. Holland went on to explain their technique for gene resequencing and how it made their plant-animal hybrid possible. Dr. Kitty Faulkner became agitated, going into detail. "We predicted this outcome. It was bound to happen in a one-to-one translation of photosynthesis, and we do have the solution. But the high-ups here at Star Labs got cold feet ever since the controversy."
"What solution have you got?"
Dr. Holland wagged her finger.
"We don't know if it's a solution just yet,"
Kitty continued. "It's a hypothetical variant on chlorophyll. We call it flavophyll, due to its theoretical yellow coloring, and this would be far more than just providing the body with energy."
Holland shrugged.
"We can't say for sure just yet, and there are some theoretical concerns we haven't worked out yet."
Faulkner slammed a hand on the desk.
"And we won't figure it out without testing."
She looked at Clark, took a breath, and composed herself.
"I'm sorry. Losing all our mice has been hard. And we're just dangling here waiting for approval."
"I understand. That sounds frustrating. I hear Star Labs has a lot of red tape to navigate."
Kitty scoffed.
"Understatement of the decade."
Holland let out a heavy sigh.
"Is there anything else we can do for you, Clark?"
"Actually, yeah. I heard Thomas Morrow played a part in inspiring your research. Is that true?"
Kitty huffed.
"Oh, really? Is that what he's telling people?"
"Not exactly. It's just that he's an aspiration for a lot of scientists."
"He's an arrogant prick. Are we done?"
Faulkner excused herself, and Dr. Holland apologized for her colleague's behavior.
"I'm so sorry. Kitty's been having a hard week. She didn't take losing the mice well."
Clark wished them luck and left Linda Holland his phone number, hoping the two of them might open up to him more in the future. Whatever they knew about Morrow had Faulkner agitated. Clark hoped that fire might motivate her to talk after she'd calmed down some. The two last scientists Victor Sage had tipped Clark off to were Carter Nichols and Percival Sutter. Clark met them in their lab at the University of Gotham, where the two men worked in parallel studies, involving an interdiscipline of quantum physics and psychology. Neither of them attempted to mask their disdain. They were both put out by having to humor a reporter's questions. Nichols spoke with a perpetual grimace.
"I'll be frank with you, Mr. Kent. You probably wouldn't comprehend half the jargon needed to understand our work. There is a complicated relationship between the perception of time and its passage that allows for the subjective experience to be manipulated at the subatomic level."
Clark nodded enthusiastically.
"That certainly does sound fascinating."
Sutter cut him off.
"And we don't have the time to educate you in two PhDs to comprehend it. So I'm sure you'll understand, Mr. Kent, that this interview is largely a waste of all of our time."
"Okay, well, I assure you, I did my homework before coming, and I learned quickly."
"And I'm sure you think you do. But we're only talking to you now because the dean of the university has demanded we do so. But please, we all know this is beyond your scope. Take that homework you did and use it for your little write-up."
The two men glared at Clark, inspiring him to modify his approach.
"It doesn't seem like I have much choice. But whatever I can't figure out, perhaps I can discuss it with Tio Morrow to get a better understanding."
At the mention of this name, Sutter shouted, standing up from the table.
"Morrow's a fool!"
"What do you know about him?"
Without an answer, Sutter turned, storming out of the room in a huff. Nichols stared at Clark with his same frown, answering with barely an inflection in his tone.
"We have never met the man."
He then methodically packed his briefcase and followed behind Sutter. Back on the farm, once the kids had gone to bed, Clark shared all he had learned during his investigation with Lana and Martha. Martha served everyone mugs of hot chocolate to help them think over the mystery. Sipping from her cup, Lana proposed they were dealing with two possibilities.
"None of them like Morrow, so either he's not easy to like, or they all had an unpleasant experience with him."
This deduction clarified little. Of these two possibilities, Clark eliminated the former.
"He mostly just works virtually with his computer all day. But from what I can tell, he seems more polite than anything else. He's no Maxwell Lord, but he gets invited to be a keynote speaker at quite a few events."
Kara walked in as Clark spoke, sighing as she sat down at the table with them.
"Please tell me you're not talking about Maxwell Lord. I am so tired of constantly hearing about him."
Martha fetched Kara a mug and poured another cup of chocolate.
"Mostly we're talking about that T.O. Morrow fellow."
Kara sighed again, heavier than the last.
I am so sick of anything having to do with the Justice League International.
Clark didn't think it could be all that bad.
They can be pretty annoying, but at least they do a lot of your job for you.
Kara scoffed.
Psh, they get a whole lot of publicity for doing whatever they feel like doing, and leave the rest to us. Meanwhile, they've basically poached our numbers.
Clark remembered when the original Justice League started out with loosely over a dozen members.
7 people isn't a lot to work with.
Are you kidding? The Atom and Mr. Terrific really only do logistics now, so they're basically retired. That makes only 5 of us. Roy's resourceful and has that cybernetic arm, and Laurel has her voice, but mostly it's just me, Wally, and John Henry. There's nearly a dozen of them in the Justice League International, but they leave anything without publicity to us.
Martha patted Kara's hand.
Drink your hot chocolate, honey. It'll help.
So as not to contribute any further to her stress, Clark said nothing of his plan in front of Kara. His next move was to check in on JLI headquarters. Any hopes of spying on them from outside was thwarted when Clark learned their penthouse facility in Spain was shielded from his supervision. It was the same shielding technology Lex Luthor used in his laboratories to hide his activities from Superman. Without the ability to peek inside, Clark positioned himself high above the Justice League International's headquarters and waited for Blue Beetle and Booster Gold to return in Ted's Beetle Buggy. The hovering blue craft appeared at dusk. As the Beetle Buggy settled on the penthouse landing pad, Superman landed beside it. Both Ted Kord and Booster Gold leapt out of the airship when they saw his company. Booster, as Clark hoped, received the timing of Superman's arrival as a personal compliment.
Duders! Super Duders! Stokely! Hey, Booster. Good to see you. Yeah, Stokely.
As this exchange began, Ted came around the Beetle Buggy and stopped next to his friend. In awe, he whispered,
Stokely. Hey, Ted. Good to see you, too.
Oh, yeah. For sure, Superman. Yeah, pretty neat.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you guys wanted to show me around inside. You know, show me your break room and all the stuff I didn't get to see on the official tour.
Cherry! For Relio, Duders.
Ted's smile beamed as he looked between Superman and Booster.
Yeah, pretty cherry.
Clark nodded along.
Yeah, cherry. But one more thing. Can we keep it between us and let everyone else think I'm here to see the break room?
Booster Gold tapped his nose and gave Superman a wink.
No problemo. We totally get it, Superman.
Ted nodded excessively, unable to hide his excitement.
Yeah, you're gonna love the break room. It's like way neater than the break room at the Hall of Justice.
Duders, no compario.
Booster looked over his shoulder, calling out to his android drone.
Skeets, let's get it go already.
Skeets slowly hovered out of the Beetle Buggy and followed them inside. As they entered the facility, Clark swallowed his misgivings. He hoped not to regret being so candid with these two. Inside, Thomas Morrow appeared to be there by himself. Just as Clark had only ever seen him, he was busy at work, wearing his headset and interfacing with virtual data. As he turned toward them, Ted Kord interrupted any greeting, blurting out,
We brought Superman here to try the apple pie in the break room.
Tuners, best apple pie in the sky, brosies.
Clark played along.
You two really know how to sell a pie. I could hardly wait.
T.O. Morrow went back to his work and Clark walked by, using his unique vision to look inside this computer that Morrow spent all of his time on. Clark hoped he might gain some insight into its ability. As they walked him through the hall and showed him the living quarters and storage spaces, Clark mostly looked right through all of it, observing the cables plugged into the large computer console. They all exited through the roof, where they could receive and broadcast information outside of the shielding containing the facility. This visit seemed to offer Clark no clues as to what Morrow was up to, and the apple pie, when compared to Martha's, was mostly disappointing. On the way out, they discovered the others had returned. Stargirl and Stripesy, along with Dr. Midnight and Maxwell Lord. Clark was greeted by Lord's warm smile.
Surprise, surprise, Kal-El. I didn't realize you were coming for a visit.
These two wouldn't stop talking about the apple pie, so I had to come and give it a try.
I know, right? Some of the best apple pie I've ever eaten. And to think it was all prepared by a machine.
It was delicious.
Clark heard these words come out of his mouth and it felt like a flat-out lie. But he guessed it was better than making them all feel their pie was inadequate. Lord walked in close to Superman.
I hope you're not in a hurry. It would be great if you could stay. Maybe have a drink?
Thomas Morrow shot down this proposal as soon as Lord made it.
You'll have to get a rain check on that, Maxwell. We've got a debriefing and I need you at full capacity.
Maxwell's face fell to a frown for the briefest instance. Clark used this moment to excuse himself.
Well, I guess it'll have to be another time then.
This suggestion was enough to restore Lord's usual enthusiasm. Just the prospect of hanging out with Superman brought his smile back.
Another time it is. Fantastic.
Flying back to Smallville, Clark wondered just how much Maxwell Lord was running the Justice League International, and how much Tio Morrow was in charge. From the brief instance Clark witnessed, it seemed clear who answered to whom. Lana became fascinated by this new tidbit of information. But both of them lost interest in the mystery as the days passed into routine. With the coming of their 11th birthday, the twins returned to soccer season. Their autumn play and music recital followed directly after the harvest ball, and with winter's passing, it wasn't long before the Kents were celebrating another birthday in the spring. Turning six, Linda choreographed a short dance performance for her family with Joey's accompaniment on piano. It wasn't complicated, but she worked hard at it. Wally West managed to catch the performance when he stopped by to drop off a present for Linda, a kitten doll wearing a red bow. As usual, he couldn't stay long and disappeared in a flash as quickly as he arrived. During the course of this past year, Clark's day-to-day life had followed more regularity than ever before. Once the kids were off to school for the day, he made his rounds planting trees. On occasion, he sat in on labor negotiations when asked. Clark found the workers' demands for safe conditions did far more to curb deforestation than Superman's guidelines ever could. He didn't do much at these meetings, though his solidarity with the workers had a significant influence on the rights the workers secured. After a day of planting trees and being present when needed, Clark returned home to take his kids to their after-school activities and enjoy some time with his family. When the kids' school let out for summer break, he and Lana planned a beach day for themselves and the kids. Clark flew his family, packed in their van, to the Gulf Coast, where the water was warm. While Lana and the kids ate the sandwiches he had packed for them, Clark spotted a pod of whales. On a whim, he swam out to meet these majestic creatures. They welcomed his company and let them swim in their midst. Before heading back to his family on the shore, Clark attempted to communicate with the whales. Under the ocean's surface, he transformed into Superman, hoping the whales would recognize his radiant resemblance to his cousin, Arthur. Clark hoped they might invite the King of the Ocean to come to shore. He was unsure if his message was understood, but after lunch, while the kids built a giant sandcastle, Arthur emerged from the crashing waves, along with a young man of about the same age as Joseph and Jerome. Arthur approached wearing a big smile.
There he is, my number one man, Clark. I missed you.
He pulled Clark in for a massive hug. Clark looked back at his cousin, beaming.
Same, Arthur. I'm glad to see you got my message.
The whales don't see too many glowing dudes in the sea, so I figured it was you. But let me reintroduce you to my boy, Garth.
Clark's jaw dropped as his eyes widened.
Wow, Garth. I haven't seen you since you were a baby.
The young man squirmed under the scrutiny of others. He had a dark complexion and pale blonde hair.
It's good to meet you, Uncle Clark.
The pleasure's all mine, Garth. But let me introduce you to your cousins.
The kids all got acquainted, and Garth was instantly brought into the fold, digging moats and stacking towers. Linda looked up at their new friend with an expression of awe. Lana offered Garth and Arthur sandwiches and received an enthusiastic hug from Arthur in return.
I feel like such a jerk. I let way too much time go by without reaching out. Look at the size of these boys. I can't believe it.
Clark waved a hand, dismissing the matter.
Don't beat yourself up about it. You went through a rough patch. But it looks like you're doing pretty well now. It's good to see you back with Garth. How's Mara? Are you two doing okay?
Oh, yeah. We're good, man. We worked it out like 7 years back. But being the King of Atlantis is always crazy, so I've been slacking on coming to shore for a while now. At least when I'm not home with this guy.
Lana handed Arthur his sandwich.
And where's that?
Just a cool little village in Costa Rica. Mara set them up over there after we split up. But it's cool. I like it. It's a good place to get away from all the politics back in Atlantis.
Well, that's not as close as I'd hoped. But don't be a stranger, Arthur.
let's be sure not to go so long without getting our kids together. And I would love to see Mara again. How about you give me your address in Costa Rica and I'll write her?
As promised, Lana started correspondence with Mara through the mail. It reminded Clark of the time she and he mostly communicated through letters and postcards. One evening, as he watched her practice her piano scales, he suggested they were long overdue for a date. This time, they planned a trip to Metropolis for the two of them. Lana wanted to get a glimpse of Clark's old life in the city. He took her on a complete tour of his old haunts, including a couple new fancy restaurants he had never eaten at. Despite the ambiance these restaurants offered, when they returned home from Metropolis, Lana decidedly looked back on their lunch at Bebo's Diner as her fondest memory of the trip. Lois had brought them there when the two of them stopped by the Daily Planet to say hi. Lana couldn't stop raving about the food.
It's a good thing she took us there, because I did not know French fries could be equally crunchy and fluffy. It's no wonder you ate there so often.
Clark hadn't ever taken the time to appreciate just how delicious the diner's menu was, but in reflection, it was something he had taken for granted when he lived in Metropolis. Clark recognized how uniquely lucky he was to eat there so often. Laying in bed with his wife, Clark appreciated how lucky he was to have so much free time to spend with his family. That fall, the twins went into the 7th grade, and Linda began 2nd grade. During the first week of the semester, as Clark drove them to school, the boys argued over whether they should try out for any of the sports teams in the coming year. Linda made a suggestion.
You two should try out for the dance team.
They shot down her suggestion simultaneously.
Dancing isn't a sport.
Linda moped a second before muttering.
Well, it should be.
Clark chuckled to himself. He agreed with Linda. Immediately after she and the boys were dropped off, Clark's phone rang. It was the botanist from Star Labs, Dr. Linda Holland. She was calling from their Coast City facilities.
Clark, I know this is going to sound crazy, but you know how to contact Superman, right?
Well, yeah, I think I do. Why? What's going on?
It's Kitty. She's done something stupid. I think she did the gene treatment on herself. She's scaring me, and she's changing.
I'll see what I can do. Get yourself somewhere safe. Consider Superman on his way.
Clark left the van parked outside Linda's school as he ducked for cover to transform into Superman. Using short bursts of the Speed Force, he bolted to Coast City in a few brief minutes. Approaching Star Labs' West Coast facility, he could hear yelling and smashing inside. A hole in one of the outer walls gave Superman a clear entrance. Yet passing through it, he was met with a hurling mass of machinery. Whatever the thing that hit him had been, it shattered around him, sending metal parts in every direction. Clark admonished himself for not looking through the walls before entering. This was a rookie mistake. He was lucky none of the particles hurled toward the bystanders inside. Confirming everyone was all right, Clark turned his attention to the source of the hurled object. It was Dr. Kitty Faulkner, but she appeared different, somehow transformed. Her inner rage unleashed, she was on a rampage. Her skin was golden yellow, and her body had grown in size, muscles surging. Glaring at Superman, Kitty Faulkner snarled before she charged at him, approaching far faster and hitting with more force than he expected. Again, Clark was reminded that he was out of practice, yet reprimanding himself did nothing to help. He was rammed, back first, through the wall and pushed outside of the building. He grappled Faulkner and planted his feet, bringing their momentum to a halt, yet this only infuriated her further. With their faces mere inches apart, she roared at him. Despite his efforts to hold his ground, Clark could feel Kitty growing in his grip. Her muscles pulsed as their mass expanded, and her eyes bulged with savage rage. Hurling Superman's body around her own, she shot put him over the nearby highway, crashing into the adjacent desert brush. Clark pounced back in her direction, but Faulkner was already sprinting the distance in pursuit of her challenger. Superman flew back over the highway to head off the incoming attack, determined to keep her from barreling into traffic. As they approached one another, Clark saw the fervency in Faulkner's face, excited by the conflict. Yet at the very last moment before they collided, Clark dipped down, catching his hands under her feet. Using her own momentum, he easily tossed her beyond the highway, beyond the desert brush, and onto the nearby beach. By the time she pulled herself from the sand, Clark was there to meet her punch, cratering him into the ground. She lifted him from the crater and punched him again, sending Superman hurling down the coastline. The two consecutive blows dazed him long enough that Clark only had enough time to brace himself for the coming impact. This one was an uppercut sending him skyward, decidedly more powerful than all the previous punches. Clark barely had the wherewithal to suspend himself hovering above Faulkner's rampage. There, he took a moment of respite. Looking down from above, Clark felt sure she was even bigger than before, and perhaps still growing. Judging by her yellow complexion, Clark suspected this was the theoretical Flavafil Faulkner had spoken of when they met. If so, she was gaining her powers from the sun's solar radiation. The hot sand she was standing on probably made matters no better. No sooner than this realization dawned on Clark, she leapt into the air and delivered an impressive roundhouse kick, sending Clark hurling into the sea. Into the water, she followed him in her blind fervor of rage. Yet Clark let himself sink and let her follow. He swam away from her, ever deeper as she pursued. When she appeared to falter, Clark stopped and feigned exhaustion. As Faulkner closed in, Clark grabbed hold of her and began sinking them both, pushing them toward the deepest trenches in the sea. Clark trusted that she, like himself, was powered by a force that sustained her beyond the need for breath. If so, she could survive underwater for quite a while, yet she would still need the light to sustain her. As the waters around them grew dark, Clark could feel Faulkner's mass, shrinking in his hold. Yet when they finally found the ocean's floor, she still had sizable strength and threw them both around as Superman maintained his grip. The commotion of these two titans battling in the sea caught the attention of the nearby fish and whales. Eventually, the king of the sea, Aquaman, came along to investigate the rumors. By then, Faulkner had shrunken significantly and was on the brink of passing out. Clark worried that once she had lost her powers completely, she might drown. But Arthur arrived with impeccable timing. With his Triton, he pulled a large bubble of air from the surface and created a room for them to wait out Faulkner's transformation. When the doctor had returned to herself, she lay passed out. There, on the ocean floor, Clark explained their dilemma.
So basically, she has to stay out of sunlight, or this might happen again.
Bummer, dude. There's a lot of sunlight up there, like every day.
Exactly. Whatever she did to herself, she won't ever be able to live a normal life.
Bro, hold up. How about she come back to Atlantis with me? There's no real sunlight there, and we have like rooms and stuff. She can stay with us, and it wouldn't be as cool as being an Atlantean in Atlantis, but we could give her a pretty chill life.
Thanks, Arthur. That might be best.
This was a unique offer, and in the end, was something Kitty would have to choose for herself. Though considering her situation, Clark wasn't sure how much choice there was left in the matter. Arthur bid farewell to Clark, taking Kitty and his air bubble with him. Meanwhile, Clark returned to Star Labs to talk to Linda Holland. Clark found Dr. Holland in her lab. The space was in shambles, all of the plants destroyed. She was packing her desk into a box. Arriving as Superman, who had never formally met Linda Holland before, Clark made sure to treat this as though it were their first interaction.
Dr. Holland? Clark Kent sent me. I managed to get Dr. Faulkner to a safe place where she can recover.
Holland looked up at Superman, her face pale.
You were able to stop that?
Without light, the effect of the Flavafil wore off.
What happened to her?
She's in safe hands, though unconscious when I saw her last. But I think she'll be okay.
Thank God. Thank you, Superman.
Clark looked at the box on her desk.
Are you okay? You weren't fired, were you?
No. I just have to leave.
I'm hoping you might be able to talk to me about Dr. Faulkner. I need to know what T.O. Morrow had to do with this.
Dr. Holland's eyes grew deathly wide. She whispered,
You know about Morrow?
I don't know enough about Morrow. I need you to tell me what you know.
Linda Holland's jaw quivered.
I can't. I can't do this all again. This is just like what happened to Alec.
Alec? Who's Alec?
My husband. After he died, I just couldn't. It was just like this.
Was Thomas Morrow involved then too?
No, nothing like that. We just got caught up with the wrong people. I'm sorry, Superman. I can't do this. I just can't.
She snapped up her box and dashed out of the office. Clark said no more. This woman had been through enough. He scanned around the destroyed space in hopes of finding some scrap of evidence connected to T.O. Morrow. But there was nothing. Just like Clark was no closer to understanding this mystery. The thought of Morrow haunted Clark. From his tower in Europe and with his elaborate surveillance system, this futurist was watching the world, all the while pulling his virtual levers. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Isaac Bluefoot. Book 2 of Son of El is written and independently produced by myself. Thank you so much for joining me for this story. This is the penultimate chapter of this season, so after the next chapter, it'll be a while before we get back together. In the meantime, I hope you continue to keep sharing the show, and maybe even consider becoming a patron. Go to sonofelpodcast.com/support, and you can become a patron of my work. It's a little bit of support, but it makes a huge difference, at least emotionally. And maybe even one day, financially, who knows. But this is a commercial-free show, and we'll stay that way. So I'm really grateful to all of my patrons. Thank you. And again, thank you to everyone who shares the show, writes a review, or rates it. I really appreciate it. This story was inspired by the Superman and DC comics and characters originally created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. With additional contributions by Steve Ditko, Gardner Fox, Carmine Infantino, Bill Finger, John Sakella, Bob Kane, Mike W. Barr, Grant Morrison, Andy Kubert, Ross Andrew, Robert Caniger, Arnold Drake, Bob Haney, Bruno Premiani, Mike Sikowski, Len Wayne, Bernie Wrightson, John Byrne, Joseph Samichson, Dick Sprang, Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatisse, Kevin McGuire, Otto Binder, Al Plastino, Julius Schwartz, Gil Kane, John Ostrander, Tom Mandrake, Mort Weisinger, George Papp, Gail Simone, Megan Hetrick, John Broom, Louise Simonson, John Bogdanov, Gary Friedrich, Dan Jurgens, Hal Sherman, Jeff Johns, Lee Motor, Roy Thomas, Dan Thomas, Todd McFarlane, Jim Mooney, Mort Weisinger, Paul Norris, Robert Bernstein, Ramona Fraden, Greg Wiseman, Brandon Vietti, Phil Barassa, Jack Miller, and Nick Carty. Music in this episode was made by Blue Dot Sessions, Chad Crouch, Tyler Twombly, Poddington Bear, Aldous Ignite, Mr. Smith, Beat Mechanic, Kyle Engel, Shemmawoon, Strobatone, and Helizna CC0. See the episode notes for details. And be sure to listen to the next episode, Chapter 19, Tomorrow's Potential.